Welcome to the Shortwave Report for April 13th, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past four shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, The Voice of Russia, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and NHK World Radio Japan. We'll begin with Spanish National Radio. In Tunisia, the forerunner of the so-called Arab Spring, protesters are being beaten and not allowed to assemble. The new Spanish government is enacting strict laws to limit protest and place criminal charges on organizers. Greece has announced general elections on May 6th, the first since the debt crisis began. Iran says that it can survive for years without exporting its oil and has ceased supplying Spain in advance of the EU sanctions. Spanish National Radio.
Police in Tunisia have fired tear gas to disperse a rally to commemorate Martyrs' Day and protest against the worsening economic condition and lack of employment in the North African nation. Nearly 1,000 demonstrators turned out this morning to protest in the capital, Tunis, defying a government ban on protests.
Protesters sought shelter in neighboring streets and shops as police beat them with batons and fired tear gas into the scattered crowd. A protest on Saturday was met with similar violence. The coalition government, dominated by the conservative Ennahda party, has come under increasing pressure from a population hungry for change.
Secular opponents accuse Ennahda, which advocates political Islam, of allowing an ultra-conservative group of Salafi activists to impose their austere interpretation of Islam on the country. Salafis have held mass protests demanding the implementation of Sharia, or Islamic law. At their last protest last month, they attacked the National Theatre in Tunis, tearing down posters and roughing up actors.
The Spanish Interior Ministry is working on a series of measures to combat street violence and what it deems to be urban guerrilla warfare. The ministry is looking at legal changes to confront possible future social unrest. The measures would involve the creation of new offences. For example, if a person or a group organise a demonstration via internet or other social media and someone attending that demonstration ends up setting a trash bin on fire, the organiser will be charged with having committed a crime.
Spain's Interior Minister, Jorge Fernández Díaz, told Congress that the reform would make any serious disturbance of public order come under the existing crime of belonging to a criminal organization. The minister added that passive resistance might also be outlawed.
By passive resistance, I mean the repeated refusal to obey orders given by the police or the civil guard, passively disobeying them, which is not currently on the books. We have to strengthen the legitimate authority of the police and its exclusive right to use force. It's been announced in Greece that the country will hold a general election on May the 6th. It will be Greece's first since the start of the debt crisis that has led to drastic spending cuts and violent protests. Acting Prime Minister Lucas Papadimos, an economist and former vice president of the European Central Bank, has headed an interim technocratic government since November last year with the aim of steering the country through its spiralling debt crisis. His main task was to ensure Athens was given the next tranche of its initial €110 billion bailout from the European Union and the International Monetary Fund, and then to ratify a second €130 billion bailout.
The present interim government has been backed by both the two big parties that have dominated Greek politics for decades, the conservative New Democracy Party and the socialist PASOK Party, which won the last election in 2009. But opinion polls suggest that both are likely to lose ground to left and right-wing fringe parties that have benefited from mounting anger at cuts to wages and pensions imposed in order to secure European and IMF aid.
Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, has said his country can last for years without exporting its oil. European Union sanctions against the country include a ban on oil purchases from Iran, which supplies the region with about 18% of its oil needs. The ban is scheduled to come into effect in July, but today Iranian television said that the country had already stopped crude supplies to Spain and was considering extending the measure to Germany and Italy.
Iran and the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, plus Germany, are scheduled to hold talks on Iran's nuclear program on April 14th after a 15-month interval. Failure to reach tangible agreements may lead to stricter sanctions against Iran. Iran rejects accusations by the U.S. and its allies that its nuclear activities are aimed at building weapons and claims its intentions are peaceful.
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio, heard from 5 to 6 p.m. at 6055 and podcasting at www.rtve.es. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. Iran will not allow any preconditions to the nuclear talks with the five permanent members of the UN Security Council scheduled for this weekend. The Syrian foreign minister accused Turkey of arming and assisting the opposition rebels. French presidential candidate Hollande says he will renegotiate the new European treaty and withdraw troops from Afghanistan. A viewpoint on the 10th anniversary of a U.S.-supported failed coup against Hugo Chavez. Representatives from American indigenous peoples gathered in Colombia to defend their rights and promote dialogue with their states. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Iran's Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salahi said on Monday that his country will not accept any precondition to the nuclear talks between Iran and the UN Security Council's five permanent members plus Germany, P5 plus one, scheduled for April 14th in Istanbul, Turkey, according to local satellites, Press TV. Salehi was quoted as saying, "Setting conditions before the meeting means drawing conclusions before negotiations, which is completely meaningless, and none of the parties will accept conditions set before talks." The New York Times reported Sunday that the United States and its Western allies would set demands for the upcoming negotiations on Iran's disputed nuclear program. The demands include the immediate closure of the Fordo nuclear facility in central Iran and a freeze of 20% uranium enrichment, according to the New York Times. Salehi said, "These issues are merely media speculations and we cannot base our judgment on issues reflected in the media." Head of Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Fereydoun Ababsi, said Sunday that Iran will not stop high-grade uranium enrichment. However, Iran will not enrich 20% uranium beyond its needs because it is not cheap to produce or maintain. Abbasi also said that Iran will not close down the underground Fordo enrichment site near the central city of Qom because of Western pressure. The Iranian atomic chief said the demands of the P5 plus 1 to suspend the enrichment activities in Fordo site is illogical, and added that building a nuclear site underground is a countermove to the strike threats by some countries.
Syrian Foreign Minister Walid Mualen accused Turkey of arming the opposition rebels and assisting them in entering Syrian territory. According to Mualen, the Syrian government withdrew military units from certain provinces. He said the ceasefire should begin the international observers arrive in the country. He went on to say the Syrian government has already implemented other points of the peace plan, including releasing individuals who had participated in the disturbances. The presidential candidate representing the Socialist Party of France, François Hollande, said that if he wins next elections, he will renegotiate the new European treaty, which he says pays more attention to austerity and legal discipline than to growth. Following declarations in the television channel Etel, the socialist candidate wants to establish more flexible deadlines in order to reduce the budget deficit. With regards to the Afghan conflict, Hollande said that if he wins the elections, he will withdraw French troops in Afghanistan by the end of 2012. According to the surveys carried out in Paris, François Hollande will win the second round of elections.
The Venezuelan people remain in the streets defending the Bolivarian Revolution, which has brought about social and economic transformations in a country that lacked social equality until 1999. That country has openly faced the manipulation of the oligarchy supported by the U.S., which has attempted to ruin the process carried out in the South American nation led by Hugo Chavez. As example of this manipulation is a coup that took place on April 11, 2002, carried out by the Venezuelan elitist organizations with the support of the leader of the armed forces, the media, and the U.S. The imposed government, led by the head of the employers' organization, Pedro Carmona, lasted just 3 days. During this short period, those who took part in the coup eliminated the constitution, dissolved the public powers, and persecuted ministers and other political figures supporting Chavez. As President Chavez said, they claimed democracy while they eliminated the National Assembly, the state power, and persecuted individual people. Thanks to the Venezuelan people and the loyal soldiers, President Hugo Chavez took back the power again. During his captivity in the naval base of Turiamo, Aragua, Chavez wrote, "I declared I have not resigned from the authentic power the people gave to me." Today, Venezuelan people celebrate the 10th anniversary of the popular revolution and they pay tribute to the fallen. So, April 11th will be declared the International Day of the Fallen Soldiers in the struggle for the independence and national freedom. People in Venezuela remain alert to prevent any other attack from the oligarchy, especially now when the elections are coming up soon and the opponent candidate is Enrique Carriles, the head of the right in Venezuela who besieged the Cuban embassy in Caracas 3 years ago. For Radio Havana Cuba, editorial desk, I am Brenda Alvarez.
More than 150 representatives of various indigenous peoples from the Americas gathered Wednesday in the Colombian city of Cartagena to defend their rights and promote dialogue with their states. Gathered for the social forum held amid the 6th Summit of the Americas, the indigenous people also plan to talk about various topics, including the 5 points to be discussed at the meeting of heads of state. Participants will also analyze the impact of these meetings for the communities of the continent and make their own proposals to the heads of state and government. Spiritual leaders from indigenous groups of Colombia led a ritual which marked the beginning of the social forum, which was also attended by Secretary General of the Organization of American States, José Miguel Insulza, and Colombian Foreign Minister, María Ángela Holguín.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 1 p.m. to 2 at 11760, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 6 p.m. to midnight at www.radiohc.cu, and now podcasting at World Radio Network, WRN.org. On to the Voice of Russia. This year marks the 40th anniversary of America's war on drugs. A recap of the ineffectiveness of this operation and a preview of what Latin American leaders intend to tell President Obama at this weekend's Summit of the Americas in Colombia. The Voice of Russia.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of the U.S.'s war on drugs. And we'll take this opportunity to shine a critical spotlight on the 40 years of this failed policy. Since the declaration of a war on drugs 4 decades ago, America has spent at least $1 trillion on the drug war. In 2009, it cost U.S. taxpayers at least $51 billion at the state and federal level. That's $169 for every man, woman, and child in America, and that's not counting opportunity costs or costs at the local level.
Millions of people have been incarcerated for low-level drug law violations, resulting in a drastic racial disparities in the prison system. Yet drug overdose, addiction, and misuse are more prevalent than ever. hundreds of thousands of lives in America have been lost to overdose and drug-related disease because cost-effective and life-saving interventions are not sufficiently available.
The war on drugs drives mass incarceration of Americans. More than one in every 100 American adults is behind bars. In 1980, the total U.S. prison and jail population was about 500,000. Today, it is more than 2.3 million. The U.S. incarcerates more people than any other country in the world, both per capita and in terms of total people behind bars. The U.S. has less than 5% of the world's population, yet it has almost 25% of the world's incarcerated population.
The number of people behind bars for drug law violations rose from 50,000 in 1980 to more than 500,000 today, an increase of a whopping 1,100%. Drug arrests have more than tripled in the last 25 years, totaling more than 1.63 million arrests in 2010. More than 4 out of 5 of these arrests were for mere possession, and 46% of these arrests, or 750,000, were for marijuana possession alone.
Arrests and incarceration for drugs, even for first-time, low-level violations, can result in debilitating collateral consequences for an individual and their family. A conviction for a drug law violation can result in the loss of employment, property, public housing, food stamp eligibility, financial aid for college, and the right to vote, even after serving time behind bars.
The war on drugs is the new Jim Crow. While African Americans comprise only 13% of the U.S. population and 13% of drug users, they make up 38% of those arrested for drug law violations and 59% of those convicted of drug law violations. Relative to the population, African Americans are 10 times more likely than whites to be sent to prison for drug offenses.
However, some world leaders are starting to notice the horrendous toll that the failed war on drugs has taken, and are beginning to do something to correct this horrible wrong. When President Obama arrives in Colombia for a hemispheric summit this weekend, he will hear Latin American leaders say that the U.S. orchestrated war on drugs, which criminalizes drug use and employs military tactics to fight gangs, is failing, and that broad changes need to be considered.
Latin American leaders point out that the United States remains the world's largest drug market and that there have been record levels of violence from Venezuela to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Mexico as a result. Cesar Gaviria, a former Colombian president, said American officials acknowledge the failure of the policy behind closed doors and do little to defend it publicly. He said it is simply a policy on automatic pilot. Speaking in his Bogota office, Gaviria said, "You reach the conclusion that all of this killing in Mexico and Central America has been in the name of a failed policy that the United States does not believe in or vigorously defend."
Amanda Fielding, director of the Beckley Foundation, a UK think tank, said, "We need to create drug policies which are evidence-based, health-oriented, harm-reducing, cost-effective, and recognize human rights. The goal of a nation's drug policy is to protect the well-being of that national community. Through its failure to achieve this aim, the war on drugs has become one of the most pressing policy challenges of the modern world."
In a statement, Fielding said, "The war on drugs has not been and cannot be won, and governments have a duty to explore new policy options. Drug policy reform must no longer be a taboo subject within politics. The meeting, therefore, represents a major initial step on the road to change."
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 11 at 15425-9800 and 9665, or through their website, www.english.ruvr.ru. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. As life expectancy surges in Europe, the age of retirement for workers has been raised and will continue to do so. Radio Deutsche Welle.
Looked at globally, Europeans live long, healthy lives, with emphasis on the long. Life expectancy around the continent has surged over the past decades, and as a result, the retirement age has also gone up and will continue to do so. The EU is launching an initiative to make Europeans more productive in the twilight of their lives. But are these people really willing to put in more years on the job for the greater good? From Copenhagen, Holly Fox takes a look.
At this construction site in Copenhagen, Denmark, workers are retrofitting an older, outdated apartment complex. Today, they are using a large crane to lift window panels up to the fourth floor. The man hooking the panels up to the crane also looks a bit older than most of his colleagues, with gray hair peeking out from under his hard hat. But he's hardly outdated, especially at a construction company like Enemerica & Petersen, which prides itself for its older worker-friendly policies, as the company's COO, Henrik Milke, explains.
We can make special agreements with them so they can work less hours a week. They can not work on Fridays, so they are having 3 days in a row. That also means they are able to stay longer than compared with if they were working full-time.
Enemerica & Petersen isn't so accommodating to its older workers just to be nice. It's simply responding to the new demographic reality. Europeans are getting old. In 1990, those 55 years old and over represented just 25% of the European Union's population. That group grew to represent 30% in 2010 and is projected to reach around 40% by 2060. That's a problem because the generous retirement allowances of many European countries are based on there being several workers for every pensioner. The plans were devised in the 1950s and 60s when there were lots and lots of young people in the workforce and life expectancies didn't go much past retirement age. That's no longer the case. Europeans are living longer, healthier lives and their families have gotten quite small. What to do about it? Well, the European Union is pushing to increase retirement ages across the bloc and get people to work longer. The European Commissioner for Employment, Andor Laszlo, says times have changed and so should the policies.
The content and the nature of work is changing. I think it's very important to reduce the early retirement practices, to eliminate incentives to early retirement, and if possible, to introduce incentives for working longer, even potentially after statutory retirement age.
This year is the EU's Year of Active Aging. The not-so-subtle message is that Europe would like its workers to work longer. Like other EU countries, including Germany and France, Denmark has already bumped up the age at which workers can begin receiving a full pension. It's now 67. By the time some of the young men working on this site retire, it could be up to 70.
Can you imagine working until 70?
Not until 70, but maybe 60. But I think we have to have earned a lot of money so we can go on pension before 70.
That's the plan.
Yes.
Make a lot of money.
Yes, exactly.
According to new data from the EU, many Europeans think they will be physically able to do their jobs past the official retirement age, and one-third even say they would like to keep working past that age. But beyond the statistics, it's difficult to know what retirement will be like for each individual. Lloyd is a 79-year-old Brit who spent his career working for his country's embassy in Denmark. He stopped work at 72 when health problems made it difficult to keep going, and now he's temporarily being cared for in a rehabilitation center. Theoretically, he says he's in favor of people working longer.
If a person is well, he's got good health, and he mustn't be demented, he's supposed to be clear of his mind, then why not work? But there comes a point where if I'd have known what I've known now, my wife, she died 5 years and 3 months ago. If I'd have known then what I know now, then I would have stopped work a little bit earlier. I've been with her longer, but you don't know whether these things are going to happen.
The phrase work-life balance may have become stale with overuse, but it's a real goal with real consequences for people like Lloyd. The EU is struggling with the same issue, albeit on a much larger scale, trying to figure out what counts as a good life's work and what kind of post-work life its citizens deserve. Holly Fox, DW, Copenhagen.
That report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Donations are the only financial support I receive for producing this program, so please help if you can. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. an insight on the growing opposition to nuclear power plants in China. China currently has 15 nuclear power plants and is working on 26 more. NHK Japan.
In today's edition of Insight, we examine reports of growing concern among the population in China over the safety of nuclear power plants. Nuclear energy is powering China's economic growth. The country has 15 reactors in operation and is building 26 more. But the nuclear accident in Japan last year caused people in China to worry about the safety of these facilities. NHK World's Makoto Oda provided the following report from Beijing.
In Jiangxi Province in southeastern China, workers are breaking ground for a plant that is to have four reactors. Officials are trying to reassure the public about safety. On the roadside can be seen a sign that says the government can prevent all accidents. But residents of a nearby town along the Yangtze River are not convinced. Dr. Hong Zhengji lives in the town and expresses concern, saying that if an accident like the one in Fukushima occurs at the plant, it will contaminate the river and will also affect big cities downstream. Everyone in the town depends on the river for water. Most earn their living from farming. They'd lose their livelihoods if the water were contaminated. Even a scientist who has been involved in the development of nuclear weapons is against the plan. A member of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, He Zuoxiu, wrote the government after the accident in Japan with a warning. He says the accident at the Fukushima Daiichi plant taught scientists that they don't understand nuclear power well enough. He says he wants to warn the public and national leaders. Concerned citizens are also starting to win over local representatives to their view. Wanjiang County in Anhui Province is across the river from where the power plant is being built, and filed a petition against the project last November. A local authority opposing a national project is almost unheard of in China. County official Wang Jihong says if the Fukushima nuclear accident hadn't happened, people there wouldn't be so strongly opposed to nuclear plants. He says he believes the government will cancel the construction, and adds that priority should be placed on the lives and health of residents. Government officials had aimed to increase China's nuclear power generation capacity by around eightfold between 2010 and 2020. They reportedly aim to eventually have 70 reactors in operation. Opposition from the people they govern may, however, force them to start rethinking this ambitious plan.
In today's edition of Insight, we heard a report from Beijing by NHK World's Makoto Oda.
That report was from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 10 p.m. to 10:30 at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcasters using a shortwave radio at home. It's far simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.